Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. That's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Zotanya Sujon about her new book, The Social Media Age. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. You've written an incredibly kind of timely book that captures so much of, I guess, the kind of, you know, contemporary problem, but also maybe the kind of contemporary good sides, is that the right word, of the world in which we live, mediated through, as the book describes, this phenomenon of social media. And I suppose the place to start with the book is a really kind of deceptively simple question, which is, well, what are social media? And that's obviously, you know, a simple but huge question. And I was quite struck in the first chapter by the way you tried to introduce a kind of a couple of themes to answer that, and a couple of examples. And you've got stuff like how social media is about kind of surveillance and data, thinking about the social credit system in China, but then how social media is about kind of community and making connections, with the example of Pokemon Go. So maybe a kind of a slightly easier question to answer is what do those two examples tell us about how we define and understand social media?
I mean, thank you. I think that's a really good question. And although, as you said, you know, what are social media seems like a simple question, it's really, really, really not. And I mean, the story behind why I wanted to start with a descriptive chapter, you know, which identified themes rather than definitions, is I spent a long time, you know, months and months, and I've been studying social media for a long time, and prior to social media, participatory media and digital technologies. So you'd think it would be simple, but there's a lot of changing definitions and then, you know, arguments about what that definition is. So in the pursuit for, you know, a comprehensive and all-consuming kind of perfect definition, I got a little bit bored. I was like, in some ways, kind of tired myself out trying to think of the perfect definition. And I also realized that because social media are changing so exponentially and from year to year, and there's new features and there's apps within apps and social media within social media, and, you know, all of these things, that actually having one definition isn't necessarily helpful. So to kind of spread out, to lay the territory, to understand that context, I thought what was really useful was just to identify some of the often oppositional themes, you know, data and surveillance. And with data, we get data valence, we get data extraction, we get exploitation, and community and connection. And I think that often when it comes to research on social media, there tends to be an alignment with one or the other. And I wanted to counter that because I think that, you know, no matter what your lens is, data and surveillance are absolutely founding starting points for thinking about what social media do and what they are. But so is, at the same time and often in the same breath, community and connection. So that was what I was trying to illustrate there. And I mean, China's social credit systems, and in particular, I think I looked at a couple of apps, which are pilots, because there is no one coordinated national social credit system. There's a series of pilots which operate independently through the approval of the Bank of China. So I looked at particularly WeChat Payment Score and Zima or Sesame Credit, which are opt-in social credit systems. And I thought they were just really interesting apps. And it's a really interesting context because there's so much going on there. And the specter of surveillance is so so clear that it just it almost allows us to look through a magnifying glass at some of the concerns and issues around data valence and surveillance. So in brief, what they do, for anyone who might not be familiar with them, is they, you know, link together national identity, identity numbers, you know, passports, tax data, all that sort of stuff, with social media behavior through and your financial information. And this is done in through a kind of gamified app. When I've talked to Chinese users, they're often surprised and perhaps taken aback by the surveillance concerns, because they're like, well, it's fun and it's social and it's there's all these rewards you get when you use it. So there's an interesting framing there. Sorry, just as a note of context, that little squeak, I do have a dog in the background, so as I talk. So the thing that's interesting, I guess, about these apps is, one, they're about not just surveilling behavior, but about bringing together a whole aggregate of different kinds of data to build pictures about, you know, what people are doing. And then their behavior can be monitored and rewarded or blacklisted. And there's a whole range of accounts, I think, in the press, which document the kind of red lists and blacklists which these systems, these apps have developed. You know, so for example, if you get over a certain number of points, you can get fees waived in terms of, you know, renting properties. You can be fast-tracked in terms of travel. And if you're blacklisted, you can have, you know, you will not be able to buy train tickets, for example. So that, I guess, one of the things that is so powerful about these opt-in social credit apps is that the potential use of data, particularly in different national systems or an authoritarian political system, you know, is frightening, especially if it's going to be misused. I do feel it's really important to say that, you know, it is important to think very carefully about these apps. A lot of Chinese scholars have pointed to techno-orientalism and, you know, racism and how it is that these technologies and the Chinese context is understood. And I think that's a very important point. You know, what we see with these apps are actually a lot of very similar apps and similar types of systems in the US and in Germany and Europe. You know, for example, there's ones which are much less known, such as FICO, which is a social credit system based in Silicon Valley. And it does all sorts of consumer analysis, including debt recovery. There's, you know, Lodex in the Netherlands, there's Schufa, all of these things bring together social credit in ways that link social data with financial and other kinds of, you know, government held data. So it's certainly not just the Chinese context. However, they all highlight the power of surveillance and data valence in terms of monitoring behavior. At the very other realm, or what seems like the other end of the spectrum, in opposition to data valence, we get, you know, Pokemon Go, which might not typically be what we think of when we think of social media, but it is, you know, they are networked. It is about connecting. It is gamified. So people who play Pokemon Go, you know, venture out into the world. And I think when Pokemon Go was first released as a game, people, you know, were, it was celebrated in the press. People are leaving and walking. They're getting exercises. They're making connections with people they hadn't anticipated. So it was also seemed to highlight some of the ways in which, you know, real connection and real communities are built around sharing of interests and that sort of digital connection. Somewhat perhaps ironically, you know, Pokemon Go is a Google platform, a Google app, and they similarly use the game to collect, you know, all sorts of information for Google Earth. And, you know, so there's a lot of geodata which is collected. So there's another side of that community and connection that we see in Pokemon Go, which links back, I think, to the data and surveillance, which is highlighted in the two apps, which are part of, you know, the pilot for China's social credit systems.
I mean, if they're like two sort of contemporary examples of community and surveillance, to pick out two of the kind of four themes that animate the front end of the book, where have they kind of, I suppose, where have they come from? Could you sort of talk through how they've ended up at a moment where, even when we're describing the kind of fun of Pokemon Go, we're talking quite critically about, you know, kind of data gathering practices, and even where, you know, we're talking quite critically about social credit systems, whether in China or elsewhere in the US or in continental Europe, we're also talking about building community and people connecting and, you know, people kind of enjoying the gamified elements. And what's the, I guess, the kind of the story of the sort of prehistory of social media to our, you know, more critical moments?
Thanks. I mean, I think that's a really, really important question. And that is something that I take up in directly in chapter two. And as a bit of context for that, I think it is really important to know where things come from. For anyone who's, you know, talked about social media with others or any, you know, new technologies, often whenever there is a new innovation, people will say, oh, it's brand new. It's never existed before. And in my experience, I think with students, particularly with undergraduate students, you know, they're like, oh, I want to look at Clubhouse. It's never existed before. It's brand new. There's nothing else I could possibly look at that will help me understand Clubhouse. And, you know, that can be kind of frustrating, I think, because, yes, it's important to understand innovation. However, Pokemon Go, social credit systems, Jima credit, all of these things do have histories. And social media does come from somewhere. It didn't just emerge out of nowhere. So in chapter two, I argue, in part to kind of develop historical precedents, but also to think about social media as part of our media ecosystem, as a landscape for so interpersonal interaction and, you know, public conversation. It's and I think that's really important, because although each platform is very different, each app or social media site is very different, there's also some commonalities. So there was those two reasons. And so what I argued actually is that we drawing from life cycle models, so I looked at the product life cycle, the knowledge life cycle, the life cycle for technological change, and also for technology. And all of these have sort of common points, which I, you know, brought together and argued that there's actually four stages when we look at where does that social media have come from. I think you could probably say there's more, or, you know, they could be different, but I think that these four stages are actually really effective for understanding that question, where is it that these apps and social media sites come from. So the first of these, I argue, in terms of social media, and this is not the web, but this is not networks, this is just social media, there's a prehistory which we can begin with in the 1980s. And here we get, you know, the basics of the internet, ARPANET, Usenet, bulletin board systems, we get email. And what we see here is that there's some technological innovations which are not social media, but they made possible social media to develop. We also get sort of concepts where, you know, scholarship and researchers are thinking about how to make sense of these technologies, things like virtual communities, public communication, computer-supported collaborative work. And, you know, for me, that relationship between how we understand these technologies and what these technologies enable is also really important. So in this prehistory, and one word I really like to help understand this prehistory is ferment. You know, this is where it is that innovations were happening to charge, to develop, to allow social media to take root. And I think that that's actually a very useful way of looking at it. The second stage is about the early development. And this is where you begin to see social media look a little bit like what it looks like. So other technological innovations at this time was groupware, which was kind of a word used for things like, technologies that allowed you to work together. I think Lotus Notes was one. We see the emergence of the World Wide Web. So the time frame is the 1990s to, and I've put it to 2006, and there's a specific reason for that. Which we'll come to in a moment. Peer-to-peer networks, which were really important and really key to how it is that social media were to be able to develop. Social software, which was sort of one of the places where groupware went, and also actual social networking sites like Six Degrees and MySpace and Facebook, as well blogging, which has got another huge impact in how it is that we connect. And then the reason why I thought the 2006-2007 moment actually marks two different stages is that there were a number of things that happened in 2007. So in this stage, I say this is stage three, which marks the consolidation and growth of social media. And probably the two major things are platformization. We see the emergence of Facebook Connect, which we know now as Facebook Login, which allows, and this happens with Google, and this happens with a number of other sites. You can log into one site somewhere else on the net through, your social account. So that's one, and that marks the extension of sites across the web, and that's a really huge technological innovation. The second one is the launch of the iPhone, and what this meant is that social media all of a sudden became linked to mobile networks. Facebook went mobile first as a company, so its strategy completely changed and adapted to the affordances and capacities of the iPhone. And this also led to the development of apps. So these were really, really big technological changes, which marked a shift away from sort of early development to really consolidating the capacities of social technologies. And from here, we see, huge growth. And I would say at this point that the fourth stage, which is what we're in now, is about maturation and the more critical turn. And I've called it the more critical turn because I think we are seeing many more works emerge which really question the meaning, the consequences, and the aims of social media in critical ways. But the other thing that we also see is massification. Facebook has over 2 billion users, and we see extension of platforms. We see the closing out of, the strangling of competitors, as came clear in the Cambridge Analytica, as the results of the Cambridge Analytica case. The advantage as well is this increased or this more critical turn, we also see a space in policy and regulation where social media platforms and big tech companies are coming under fire for antitrust and monopolization. So that's where it is that I think we are now. I guess just one final comment on this. And now that I'm thinking, Dave, I'm going back to the question, where did Pokemon go? And Zhima credit and other sorts of, social credit systems come from. I think it's complicated and we could probably trace back these particular technologies in different ways. But I think they're also part of a larger landscape, and this staged model helps us understand that larger landscape. Just a final point, one of the things I learned from writing this chapter, which I thought was really quite interesting, is the gap between sort of technological innovation and how it is that we're able to think about these changes. Social media, for example, wasn't used as a term in Ofcom until 2008, even though it had been something that was in the press and in the news and used in technology communications. So there's something quite interesting there, I think, which is important for when we think about where we are in terms of criticality and how we can get there more quickly.
I mean, you mentioned lots and lots of kind of different key developments and key players in the story, and the middle part of the book, I guess, tries to map out some more of that where we are now territory. And I suppose one thing you flagged, particularly with giving quite a bit of attention to Facebook there, is the rise of a social media landscape that's dominated by platforms and, you know, as part of a kind of broader sort of new infrastructure of the internet that is the social media infrastructure as much as it is the kind of World Wide Web infrastructure. And it'd probably be useful to kind of talk through, I suppose, the kind of the infrastructure provided by platforms and the way they kind of shape what we consider to be both the social, but also how platforms characterize the social media age.
That's a very interesting question. And I am certainly, you know, of the camp that infrastructure matters. It matters where our, you know, cables and wires and where buildings structures come from. And there's some amazing work in this area. So in terms of, you know, social media, one of the things that I think is interesting is if you look at, you know, the undersea cable networks, and in the book there is a picture of them, and it is something you can find by looking at telegeography, I believe. I can share a link if that's of interest. And what it shows is, you know, all of the undersea cable networks that carry the bits and the information which make up the internet. Interestingly, with platformization, you get the extension of, you know, links and sites of, you know, Google and Facebook and other social technologies. But when you look at the cables, one of the things that we see is that they're also, you know, owned and maintained and contributed to by these companies. So what this means is that when we look at infrastructure, both at the top of the web, and then when you look at the material matter, which makes it up, it's, you know, there's alignment between ownership. So I think that's something that's really key in terms of how it is that we understand not just what social media do as users, but what they do in terms of their infrastructure. And the other component of that, of course, is like, you know, data centers, where it is that they're located and what that means, I think, you know, not just for use, but also for regulation. And the broader implications of that. Does that answer your question, Dave?
No, that's perfect, and it sort of sets up, I suppose, a discussion of. I mean, so far we've been talking really about the kind of the media bits of social media. I'd say whether it's, you know, kind of platforms or programs, but less so the kind of social. And again, I mean, what one of the things that's happened with things like, as you've, you know, gestured towards their critical studies questions about, well, you know, where are the platforms based? How are they regulated? What kind of laws do they operate under? You know, et cetera, is you kind of miss the sort of the social bits. And the book has got a range of different kind of maybe cultural case studies that it uses. And one really, really obvious one, which is less kind of Facebook and more Twitter, is Black Lives Matter. And it struck me that was something that the book uses to kind of say, well, look, social media have got a kind of a promise of being participatory as much as we need to be critical of, you know, whose voices are represented, who's are marginalized, who gets to kind of be involved. And I wonder how you use the kind of hashtag Black Lives Matter as a case study in the kind of the social and participatory elements of social media.
I mean, Black Lives Matter is actually a really amazing and positive case of how it is that social media can, you know, really make visible all sorts of voices which haven't been heard or have been, you know, not heard as much as they should be. So I think that, you know, one of the things that's quite interesting when you look about, you know, look at Black Lives Matter, when it first emerged, it was, you know, barely noted on Twitter. And I think although Twitter is perhaps one of the primary sites where Black Lives Matter has been documented, it is something that has, you know, gone across other sites, including, you know, web spaces and including newsletters and emails and all sorts of things which, you know, are difficult to bring into the story, but they're absolutely present. And again, that sort of that landscape element. But, you know, when it first emerged in 2013 in response to the acquittal of Trayvon Martin's racist murderer, you know, it was quite quiet on Twitter. There wasn't, you know, massive amounts of activity. However, that impact was accumulative, and as more cases were documented, as more as the hashtag was contributed to over time, it amplified not just the voices of people who were angry about systemic racism, but also about voices which had not been picked up by mainstream media, or that had been in some ways suppressed by, you know, police and by racism, not just in the States, but globally. So in that sense, you know, Black Lives Matter is a really excellent example of how we can see social media amplifying voices and enabling greater participation. It provides more opportunities to make visible injustices that would otherwise not have been recognized. So I think that that's, you know, it's a great example for that. And I think it did enable all sorts of people to come together, and not just to come together, but to see other people who were going through the same anger and frustration and, tragic response to these horrible continuing injustices. So I think this was really valuable in that way. And when we look at social and political movements, it's not just Black Lives Matter. We can see this in other instances as well. Interestingly, you know, for example, in Egypt, in the 2011 revolution, one of the things that some researchers have noted is that it was most valuable, Twitter was most valuable, and to some extent Facebook, in connecting what was happening in Egypt to Western journalists and to global journalism. So again, that making visible in a wider arena, that was the thing that was so powerful in terms of participation and in terms of, you know, change. The other question, of course, and it would be interesting to hear what you think on this, Dave, is that when we think about critically about participation, although there's some, you know, really excellent examples of how social media can amplify voices and connect people, there's also many questions around what it is that participation really means. And if, you know, and this is something that I think is challenged when we look at who it is that generally has access, who has reach and scope and scale using social media, which often comes back to, you know, stories about the usual suspects and those who have more political and economic power.
I mean, there's a question that goes even further beyond that, and the book engages with, which is around, well, actually, you know, these moments of great social hope and social positive social change are still dependent on platforms. And I mean, you know, we've seen, like, literally over the last couple of weeks, how various key platforms have, you know, switched on and switched off particular hashtags and particular kind of, you know, critical discussions around the health crisis in particular nations. And this question, I guess, is not just a sort of, you know, story of platforms, but it's also a story of, like, well, who owns you when you're in the world of social media? You know, even with kind of something like hashtag Black Lives Matter, there was still, I suppose, a kind of a compromise of using that hashtag and using that platform in a world where, you know, it was very difficult to stay private. You know, obviously there are debates about people's anonymity on things like Twitter. Facebook faced a backlash when trying to kind of, I suppose, crack down on anonymity. And then this question of, you know, who owns your data and thus who owns you? And that question I think is really fascinating, because it doesn't sort of completely invalidate the participatory promise. But I suppose one of the things you're trying to talk through in the later part of the book is the idea that you have to be aware that, you know, privacy is a contested and difficult terrain.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a whole chapter on that, and that comes from research that I've done as well, looking at privacy in sharing culture. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really important, and I mean, there's a lot there. So I think let me deconstruct this a little bit. So when we think about privacy and data ownership, I mean, quite clearly, terms and conditions, which many people don't read. In fact, I think it's the exception for people to read those, you know, it basically assigning away your rights to your information and to your data, and also often granting access to, you know, to your computer or to your phone, to any files, photo albums, address books, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's a lot of information. So it's not possible to opt out. And I think as well, if we look at shadow profiles, which is the collection of data from social media users about non-users. So Dave, if you didn't have a social media account, but I had your phone number and I logged into my social media account or opened a social media account, you know, I am giving away access to all of that information. And, you know, this is common practice in social media. And we've seen it not just in Facebook, but in LinkedIn, in Twitter, in all of the, you know, it's one of the sort of common business models. And that means that through the collection of data about non-users, shadow profiles can be built. And if you or whoever has had data collected about them logs on, that data can then be linked up and the platform, whatever that is, can say, look, do you know this person and this person? So in this sense, it's impossible to be private in how we might understand privacy as a right to be, let alone as a right to have control over information. And I think that there's sort of two, well, there's one major consequence of this. And before getting to that consequence, one of the things many people, including, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, Jeff Bezos and many other big tech CEOs say, is that, you know, privacy is dead. We don't need to think about it. People don't care about privacy. And that is, you know, based on my research and the reading I've done on that, absolutely not the case. People do care about privacy, but what they tend to care about most is interpersonal or social privacy. Who, you know, what other social media users, what potential employers or current employers, what family, what, you know, the people they know or might know might see. And I think one of the reasons why that is I think there's two reasons, and this has got to do with some of the consequences. One, when it comes to framing privacy, social media typically say you have control, you have all the privacy you want, and that has nothing to do with intellectual property or data or any of that sort of stuff. You know, you can control this sort of thing. So I think that there's actually an active lie being promoted and perpetuated by social media companies where we're misled about what privacy means. And we're sort of misdirected continually from thinking about privacy and data. So I think that that's a problem. And I think that in terms of how to be private on social media or the internet, this is something that we need to do more work on, and that social media companies need to do more work on and make some actual policy changes around terms and conditions, but also around their practices and how it is that privacy is understood and how it is privacy is presented. You know, they need to be much more responsible in respecting privacy and data rights. The other element is that one of the things that we do see with, you know, studies with young people is that, you know, privacy is also a, you know, it's contextual, you know, as Niesenbaum argues. So many people, you know, if you look at Finstagram, fake Instagrams or fake TikToks, people find ways to be private in public. And I think that's really interesting because it, one, supports the idea that yes, privacy is important, but it also shows that, you know, people are quite resourceful and resilient and figure out how they can connect with others in ways that they feel safe and secure. This is also something that's come out from my own research. You know, people talk about using codes or they talk about using back channels. So they'll post statuses or share material, which is encoded so only a small number of people will understand what it means, or they'll use back channels instead of, you know, public facing channels to communicate and connect. So I think we need to understand these things as working together, and not just as, you know, as different aspects of privacy which cancel each other out, because they're both very real and very important for understanding, you know, what happens on social media and how it is people engage and understand, you know, big things like data and privacy.
I mean, those same themes are present in parts of the book that are talking about dating, about, you know, influencer culture, through to things that, you know, questions about, you know, can you actually be like authentic and be yourself really on platforms like Instagram. And I mean, the book has got so many examples and is, you know, incredibly rich, far beyond the conversation that we've had. And I wonder actually if the place to wrap up might be a slightly kind of sort of cruel and unusual question, considering you've written such a, you know, a kind of comprehensive overview of the social media age. And that question is, so what are you going to do next then? Are you going to work more on social media? I mean, that there are, you know, several different research agendas that I spotted that could easily develop from the book. You mentioned actually, you know, your own separate research projects that have underpinned some of the chapters and case studies. So yeah, what kind of things are you going to be working on after the social media age?
What a wonderful question. So there's so many ways to answer this, and thanks so much for, you know, reading the book and for these questions. So the two projects I have, you know, on the go at the moment, there's one on data epistemologies, and this does carry on from some of the themes within the book. And the project aims to look at the different tools, you know, from social network analysis to sentiment analysis, to web scraping, to look at these different tools and what kinds of knowledges they bring, you know, what are the lenses they bring to make sense of different web and social media contexts. And so what I'd like to do is compare them with the aim to understand what those epistemologies are and how they work together. Because I think this is the other question we have, is there's so much change, and so many emerging tools. And I think that this would be a very interesting way to make sense of, you know, how to make sense of our changing digital world. So that's one project. Another one is I'm working with Harry Dyer, Mark Kerrigan, and Hugh Davies on looking at digital inequalities in education. And that's a well-established area, as you know yourself, your own work on inequalities in the cultural industries. You know, we're looking to that as well. But yeah, that is another project. And then, of course, there's two, which I'm absolutely desperate to do, but will probably not be until next year. And that's looking at social credit users, you know, particularly Chinese social credit users, and trying to understand their experience and how they make sense of not just surveillance, but also perhaps cultural belonging, and how it is that these apps make sense of that. And there's also a project on digital dating, but which I'm very keen to do at some point in the future. So those are my projects on the go. Can I ask you the same question, Dave? What are you looking to do next?
I mean, it's funny because obviously it's your podcast that, about your book, but actually, you know, lots of quite similar things, and particularly thinking about the impact of the pandemic on things like digital cultural consumption, and this question about, you know, is it the case that arts organisations should all now massively pivot to digital? Or actually, is it the case that, you know, the moment of kind of digital engagement that we saw mid-2020 is a bit like the kind of Facebook's pivot to video scandal? You know, it was a sort of a bit of a kind of false dawn, and, you know, are people quite bored of the digital now, you know, happy to sort of engage with particular platforms like TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, but really craving a return to a, you know, a kind of digitally assisted in terms of connections, but maybe, you know, kind of not digitally mediated world. And we shall see what happens over the next kind of year or so.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I think that I don't know if you have explored Clubhouse at all, but Clubhouse is an audio based, you know, social media app only available to Apple users. And my view is that it's actually really got, you know, potential to become quite successful precisely because of the pandemic moment and the visual exhaustion of so many of the sorts of work-based and social technologies that we're using. So yeah, interesting question. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, and look forward to seeing more of your work, particularly I think I mentioned, you know, several of those later book chapters could certainly have, you know, research projects and books on their own. So you've got quite a bit of work to do by the sounds of it.
Yes, thank you. And I would like to see that happen as well. So yeah, thanks so much, Dave. Really a pleasure to speak to you about the book and all, you know, everything that's within it. So I really appreciate you taking the time and being on the podcast. So hello to everyone out there and thank you for listening.